Hello and welcome to Cathagancers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. And it's open forum today. You are very welcome. If you have questions about the Catholic faith, about Christianity in general, or about just about anything else, you're welcome to call 888-318-7884. You certainly don't have to be Catholic to call. Anybody's welcome here. 888-318-7884. And Jimmy Akin is our guest both hours today. Jimmy, of course, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, the author of The Bible is a Catholic Book, among many other things, and the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Jimmy Akin, thank you for doing this with us again.
Cyril Kellett, my pleasure.
Second time in one day.
That's right. We did a pre-record earlier in the day for later next month.
For next month, yeah. We already know what's going to air on October 21st.
October 21st, yeah.
We're working you hard, but I know you like it, so I don't feel too bad about working you hard.
Yeah, no, radio's a lot of fun.
Again, 888-318-7884, the number, open forum with Jimmy Akin. What drops on Friday on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World?
So this Friday is a fifth Friday, and that means that we're doing a weird questions show. So I'm going to be answering weird questions about secret societies, binding demons, reenacting Catholic history, killing vampire-human hybrids, Neanderthals in the afterlife, how the universe expands faster than the speed of light, and quantum leaping into priests and whether they can then perform the sacraments. Also, next Friday, we have an episode on spoon bending, which will be a lot of fun.
You know, it's funny. I don't remember the quantum leaping into priest one. I feel like I should remember that one. I'll have to listen.
Based on the show Quantum Leap.
Yeah. That's a really good question. For a weird question. That's a very good one. All right, so spoon bending, that's where people bend the spoon, at least purportedly, with their brain, using their
brain?
Well,
yeah. Spoons or forks or steel bars or aluminum bars, but it's more generally called metal bending. Mm-hmm. And it may or may not involve the use of hands, but it is supposedly something that is done with it either completely by psychokinesis or with partial assistance by psychokinesis. And spoon bending is the most famous form of it, which was popularized in the 1970s by the Israeli psychic Uri Geller. But subsequent to him and his popularization of it, there had been a lot of study done on it. In fact, there was a gentleman here in California who researched it, and the way he did it was by holding spoon bending parties, where he would get a bunch of people together and they would create a party atmosphere so the people would be less inhibited, and then they would start bending spoons and forks and metal rods. And he had some fascinating research on that.
What? All right. Yeah. Looking forward to that. It's not, I mean, none of it is Iron Mike Maloney. You know, that's the one.
Iron Mike Malone, yeah.
Oh, Iron Mike Malone.
Or Malloy.
Okay.
Yeah, I told you about that one in our pre-recording.
I know, and now I'm really looking forward to it. They just couldn't kill Iron Mike Malone.
Right. He refused to die and didn't even know they were trying.
The number is 888-318-7884. Maybe you have a question about Jesus. Maybe you have a question about the Catholic Church. Maybe you have a more generally religious or moral question that you'd like to ask Jimmy, but Jimmy also loves talking about science and mysteries and anything else you want to talk about. 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. We start out today in Alberta, Canada. Mitchell, watching on YouTube, you are numero uno. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Oh, I, Jimmy and Cy?
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes, Mitchell, you're on with us.
Yes. Hello, yeah. I just have a question for you guys. There's dispensationalism and covenant theology are sort of the two primary ways of understanding Scripture. And I know dispensationalism
in some Protestant circles.
In Protestant circles, exactly.
Protestant circles. Not all Protestants.
But generally, covenant theology and dispensationalism are two large strains of understanding the text.
Uh-huh.
And my question was, I understand it's primarily a Protestant thing, but does Catholic thought lean towards one or the other. I suspect it might be covenant, but I just want you and perhaps Si's thoughts on what direction it leans on, and if you have any general thoughts on dispensationalism, just in general, just if you have anything along those lines.
Okay, so we should define our terms for people who may not be familiar with them. A version of theology that you have, both what these are both ways of understanding God's plan of the ages. And, you know, so what's the shape of God's plan for different periods in human history? How does he relate to man in these periods and so forth? And in Calvinistic circles, a common way that history has been understood is in terms of what's called covenant theology, which proposes that God relates to mankind through a series of covenants. And there are different versions of covenant theology. It's often proposed, for example, that there is a sort of Adamic covenant, even though we don't read about an Adamic covenant in Scripture that goes all the way back to the beginning of the human race. There's also sometimes in covenant theology the idea of a covenant between the Father and the Son that relates, affects how God relates to humanity, but we also don't read about that in Scripture. One characteristic of some covenant theologians, although not all of them, but many of them, is that the church has entirely replaced Israel and in God's plan. So the church is the spiritual Israel or the new Israel. It's taken over all of the promises that God made to Israel, and so there is now no distinct relationship between God and the people of Israel. Everything that was formerly said about Israel now applies to the church. Dispensationalism is common in various evangelical circles in Protestantism, and it is a theological movement that began in the 19th century, so it's more recent than covenant theology. It began with a man named John Nelson Darby in a group of the Plymouth Brethren in England, and it was popularized here in the United States by a gentleman named Cyrus Ingersoll Schofield, who wrote a reference Bible called the Schofield Reference Bible, which contained extensive notes and introductions and so forth that expounded the ideas of dispensationalism. And like covenant theology, it also proposes that God relates to mankind through a series of covenants that have been made. Classically, in dispensationalism, there were said to be seven covenants that God made, and that in during the period of each covenant, the rules of how we relate to God would change. These days, dispensationalism has frequently been modified to where a lot of the more hardcore ideas, like exactly seven covenants, have been modified. Today, I know there are like four covenant dispensationalists. Also, originally, dispensationalism had a very sharp distinction between law and grace. So the idea was the covenant of Sinai, the Mosaic covenant, was all about law and really wasn't about grace, whereas the new covenant that Jesus introduced was all about grace and not really about law. These days, thoughtful dispensationalist theologians have kind of taken the edge off of that position, because when you read the Old Testament, there's a lot about grace. And when you read the New Testament, Jesus, you know, said, I'm not weakening this stuff. He's actually intensifying some aspects of the law. So it's more of a blend of law and grace in both covenants, but there are some distinctives. And one of the things that dispensationalism has focused on very heavily is the idea that God has an ongoing relationship with the Jewish people, that the church has not simply replaced Israel in God's plan. And the belief, or a common belief in dispensationalism, is that the church is a sort of parentheses in God's plan of the ages, where up to the time of Jesus Christ, God was dealing with the Jewish people, and then he sort of paused his plan of the ages to bring in the Gentiles. And then once the full number of Gentiles have been brought in, will come out of the church age, and God will again turn to dealing with the Jewish people. In particular, classical dispensationalism has also been premillennial, meaning that they think that there will be a future earthly period of at least 1,000 years in which Jesus Christ physically reigns on earth, typically from Jerusalem, and that the Jewish temple will be rebuilt during this time, and animal sacrifices, according to many dispensationalists, will be restored, although not necessarily all of them say that, but that's a common position. So where does the Catholic Church stand with respect to these questions? Well, it really doesn't embrace either one of them. It acknowledges that God has made a series of covenants, and that he, in those covenants, gives various promises and makes various demands. And so that does have an effect on how people are supposed to relate to God. But in terms of the role of the Jewish people, the Catholic Church acknowledges that the Jew, and this is in the Catechism of the Catholic Church, it acknowledges that God has a special place for the Jewish people. They do still have a special relationship with him, and that will manifest in the future by the by large corporate conversion of the Jewish people to Christianity close to the end of the world. So Catholic theology disagrees with dispensationalism on those matters. It also, though, disagrees with dispensationalism both in terms of the sharpness of the distinctions between these ages, and it doesn't accept the idea of an earthly future millennium with Jesus physically reigning on earth, and so it's non-premillennial. So Catholic theology is sort of between these two and would regard them as each having a basis that is, you know, based on certain passages. I mean, the church is, in a sense, the new Israel, but it doesn't completely replace the old Israel. So both of these have aspects of the truth that they're focusing on, both dispensationalism and covenant theology. But they take these truths to an extreme and ignore other elements of biblical teaching.
Mitchell, thank you very much for the question. Thank you for including me in the question, but I really don't have anything to add to what Jimmy had to say, certainly. So we'll leave it there. Plus, it's time for the break, so we got to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers Live.
Do you have a question but prefer to ask it privately? Catholic Questions can help. Go to CatholicQuestions.com to ask your question online, email us, drop us a letter, or give us a call. Longtime Catholic Answers Live apologist and author Jim Blackburn or another Catholic Questions apologist will be happy to assist you. Catholic Questions proudly supports Catholic Answers Live, so visit us at CatholicQuestions.com today. That's CatholicQuestions.com.
EWTN, teaching the truth.
Well, I don't think we're like the typical college students, because we really hang out at our campus ministry and everything. It's amazing about how much more connected you feel. We share really cool articles from actually you guys, EWTN, and like what you were saying about evangelization. So that's really nice.
EWTN, live truth, live Catholic.
Back to Catholic Answers Live. We're all recovering here from our big weekend conference. Some of us getting ready to go over to Phoenix for the weekend, and the show will be joining you from Phoenix on Thursday and Friday because EWTN holds an annual radio conference, which I think has not been held for 3 years. I might be off on that, but because of all the COVID stuff and whatnot, this will be the first time to get together with all the folks. It's a wonderful conference, because we get to meet and see and hang out with all the folks who run the Catholic radio stations, many who have put their personal fortunes and their time into building these radio stations and networks. And what a great group of people. So we'll
are you gonna fly over there, or are you gonna drive?
I'm gonna fly.
Oh, really?
Yeah, get over there quick and get back quick.
I don't know that it'll save you much time, given how much time you have to waste getting to and into an airport and then waiting around. Because Phoenix, if memory serves, is only like a 5-hour drive.
Yeah.
And it's a gorgeous drive.
Yeah. And Phoenix is also the closest city with a Waffle House in it. So do you remember this, Darren? So I probably will be visiting the Waffle House in Phoenix while I'm there. Pete in Smyrna, Tennessee, listening to EWTN on Channel 130, Sirius XM Satellite Radio. You are next, Pete. Please go ahead with your question for Jimmy Akin.
You mentioned that the universe is expanding faster than the speed of light.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a question of interest. And so I would like to know what the answer to that is, or explanation for it.
For how that could be, Pete?
Yeah. So I could say, oh, you got to wait till this Friday's episode of Mysterious World, but I won't do that. So the basic idea is that physical matter, anything that has mass, cannot move faster than the speed of light. But things that don't have mass or that have negative mass could move faster than the speed of light. And from a certain point of view, Padawan, the universe as a whole does that, because the universe is expanding. And in fact, the rate of its expansion is accelerating. It's getting faster in its expansion. And even though a given area of space is expanding slower than the speed of light, when you put all of the different areas of the universe together, so the universe is like, you know, the visible universe has a diameter that's billions of light years across, tens of billions of light years across. If each one of those light years is expanding at a small rate, and you put all of those tens of billions of light years together, then the entire universe is expanding faster than the speed of light. So it's kind of a general, it's a general effect that applies to the universe as a whole, not to individual regions within the universe. But you add up all those regions, and the collective expansion of the universe is faster than the speed of light. And what that means is that every year, some stars that are very distant from us cross over what's called the cosmic horizon, meaning that because the universe as a whole is expanding faster than the speed of light, some stars get so far away from us that their light will never again reach us. And so every year, some stars slip over the horizon and we will never see them again. But that's a basic explanation of how that works. It's not a specific area in the universe, but you add up the expansion of all of the areas, and it is indeed faster than light.
Okay, Pete?
Now the galaxies have matter, but mm-hmm. the space between the galaxies doesn't have matter.
Correct. Yep.
So how do you know that the entire space between is it observable that the entire space between the visible galaxies is not expanding faster than the speed of light, because we can see them?
Well, if you look at the distance between Earth and the nearest large galaxy, between the Milky Way and the nearest large galaxy, which is the Andromeda Galaxy, well, that's actually shrinking because we're gravitationally bound to them. But for most galaxies, let's say it's a nearby galaxy that's not gravitationally bound to the Milky Way, you will see it expanding, and it will be slower than the speed of light between us and a nearby galaxy. But as you look deeper into space, the farther you get away, the faster the galaxies are receding from us. So if you look at one that is, let's say, 2 million light years away, the expansion rate is pretty slow. But if you look at one that is 100 million light years away, the expansion rate over that larger distance is faster. And if you look at one a billion light years away, it's faster yet. And if you look at one 10 billion light years away, it's faster than that. And so the deeper into space you look, the faster the expansion rate is. And eventually you see galaxies that are almost receding at us at the speed of light. And then beyond those would be the ones that have slipped over the cosmic horizon and are no longer visible, that are expanding faster than the speed of light.
Pete, thank you. Intense stuff. Thank you very, very much for the question. I hope that that was of help to you. I'm going to go to Jerry in New York, listening on the Station of the Cross. Glad to have you, Jerry. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Yeah, if I remember correctly, a couple of months ago, I heard Jimmy Akin say that he was rather annoyed at the fact that many of the people in the church are saying that Elizabeth and the Blessed Mother were cousins. And if they weren't cousins, what was the relationship, if any?
Well, I'm not annoyed at people in the church saying that Mary and Elizabeth are cousins. I could be a little annoyed at some Bible translations that have given that impression, because in Luke's gospel, it doesn't, when it describes the relationship of Mary and Elizabeth, it doesn't use the Greek word for cousin. The Greek word for cousin is anepsios, and the feminine form of that would be anepsia. Instead, it uses the word sungenes. And in Greek, sungenes does not mean cousin, it means kinswoman. And so all we can say from Luke is that Mary and Elizabeth are kinswomen. We don't know exactly what the relationship is. It could be some kind of distant niece aunt thing, since they belong to different generations. It could be some kind of cousin thing. They could be distant cousins, but the text does not specify exactly what their relationship is, so we don't know. Unfortunately, some Bibles, like the older version of the New American Bible, did translate sungenes as cousin, which is not a good translation of it. The current edition, the Revised New American Bible, fortunately fixed that, and it now just says your relation or something like that. So we can't really say what their relationship was. We know they were related, but we can't really be more specific than that based on what Luke tells us.
Okay, Jerry?
Okay, thanks. Thanks for the clarification.
Thanks, Jerry.
No problem.
Let's go to Francisco in San Antonio, Texas, listening on the app, the Catholic Answers Live app. Francisco, thanks for downloading the app onto your phone. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hello, Mr. Akin. I was wondering, what does it take for a saint to be incorruptible, and are there different levels of incorruptibility?
Okay, so what incorruptibility refers to is having less effect, having less of the corruption that you would expect from after death than what you actually see. So if you bury a body in one location, depending on things like the moisture and the temperature and whether the body is in an airtight casket, you will see various corruptions occurring over a course of time, like let's say a year or 10 years or something like that. And if someone has markedly less corruption, when you go back and look at their body after a year or 10 years or whatever, then that person is displaying some degree of incorruptibility. And there are indeed different levels of incorruptibility. Sometimes some saints' bodies will have some corruption, it's just not a lot. Others will have a little bit more, others will have less. And so there are different degrees of incorruptibility. Incorruptibility is taken as a potential sign that God's grace may be protecting this person from corruption, but it's not an automatic supernatural phenomenon, because there are non-saints and non-Christians' bodies who also display less corruption than you would expect. And so it's one factor that's taken into account when the relics of a saint are examined, but it's not considered a conclusive proof of their sainthood, which is why we don't canonize saints as soon as we dig them up.
Okay, Francisco?
Yes, sir. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very, very much. It's open forum. Jimmy Akin is our guest. And guess what? There's two lines open, which doesn't always happen when Jimmy's around. So if you'd like to get your question in, 888-318-7884. Rich in Akron, Ohio, watching on YouTube. You are next, Rich. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi. So my question is, if evolution is true, then all life forms, thus having, they all have a genome, so their genome would have to be expanding in size, and because that's in order for evolution to be a part of just the natural order of things, this would have to be constantly happening, and would always have been happening since the beginning of life forms. So has this been observed, and if so, what is this process? What's the scientific name of this process called?
All right, Rich, we'll get it on the other side right after this.
Catholic Answers Live.
What if the voice of your deepest doubts about Catholicism rose up in the form of a human being and challenged you to defend your most foundational beliefs? That's the task apologist Trent Horn took upon himself in his new book, Devil's Advocate. A dialogue with his own best objections against the faith that he professes and defends. You can stand up against your doubts, and Trent will show you how. Pick up your copy of Devil's Advocate today at shop.catholic.com or at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Want to know more about the origins of the Catholic Church? Joe Heschmeyer explores the beginnings of Christianity in The Early Church Was the Catholic Church. Joe digs deep into the words and actions of those who lived right after the apostles to refute anti-Catholic claims of how the faith was lived back then. Order your copy of The Early Church Was the Catholic Church today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Here's a question. Is it really possible to be friends with someone who died 2,000 years ago? Maybe the problem is that we've grown way too comfortable with the story of Jesus. Nice man, right? Taught us to love one another, said not to judge people. We celebrate his birthday every year. It's time to put away this small, safe version of Jesus, says Cy Kellett. Nobody that bland could have transformed the world. In A Teacher of Strange Things, Cy presents Jesus Christ undiluted by sentiment, with all his radical words and deeds uncensored. Do you know someone, your son or daughter perhaps, or maybe your mom or dad, who needs the friendship of Jesus Christ? Do you? Order your copy of A Teacher of Strange Things by visiting shop.catholic.com today or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Jimmy Akin is our guest, and it's open forum. On the line is Rich from Akron, Ohio, who wants to know about evolution. He says the genome size of all life forms should be increasing. And is that the case? And what's the name of that if it's happening? Jimmy?
Okay, so the genome is essentially the stock of genes that a life form has. And so the more complex the life form is, the larger its genome is going to tend to be on average. And so it is true that if, you know, life began with single-celled organisms, that they were very simple. You know, they didn't have to grow arms and legs and brains and things like that. And so they didn't need and wouldn't have had as large a genome as later organisms like us that do have to grow arms and legs and hearts and brains and a central nervous system and all that stuff. Now we have to be careful here, though, because it's not every organism that is going to be increasing the size of its genome over time. Organisms that find an evolutionary niche where they successfully survive and reproduce, given the current conditions that they're living in, don't have pressure to change evolutionarily. And so they'll just stay the same. And so there are some organisms like crocodiles that have been basically the same for the last 70 million years. Since the time of the dinosaurs, crocodiles have basically been crocodiles. The same thing is true of very small organisms. There are most organisms on Earth are single-celled, and they're just little microbes. They do their thing. They live very simple little lives. They don't have great aspirations. They reproduce really quickly, and so they haven't necessarily changed a whole lot. Although they have, sometimes they do. They have little microbe wars among each other, and they can change. But because of how simple they are, they don't need a big genome. But if you think about the overall sweep of the evolution of life on Earth, Rich is correct. We would have started out with single-celled organisms, and they remained the case for billions of years. According to our current scientific estimates, life began on Earth astonishingly quickly. Earth formed about 4.6 billion years ago, and very quickly after that, we had life on Earth. Some have even suggested it happened so quickly, maybe life didn't start here. Maybe it came to Earth from somewhere else. That's a theory known as panspermia. But we did very quickly after the formation of Earth have these organisms. And for the next 3.5 billion years, they didn't change much. They just remain single-celled organisms. And then between a billion and half a billion years ago, the complexity of life started to increase, and we started to get multi-celled organisms like some of the earliest that we have fossil records of were algae mats that would form on beaches. And then it gets more complex than that. We start getting early animal life. There was an event known as the Cambrian explosion, where at the beginning of the Cambrian period, there was this enormous diversification of life that gave us all kinds of creatures, many of which look really weird. We don't have anything like them today. And then it continued to increase with plants and animals on the land up until now. And for the more complex organisms, their genomes did indeed grow. And so we do see this progression in paleontology, in the history of life as judged by the remains it's left. And there are estimates of the sizes of these different organisms and how they grew. I'm aware of one estimate that suggested that among several major groups of organisms, the size of their genomes increased by a factor of 8 every billion years. So every billion years, their genomes would become 8 times bigger. And so that provides the opportunity, if you have a good indication of the size of an organism's genome, you may be able to figure out how old it is or how early its origins date to. So there can be some kind of biological timekeeping function for that. But Rich is correct. The size of genomes would increase over time, at least for complex organisms. And that has been measured. It does fit the paleontological record. And we have estimates of the growth of that. But it doesn't have a specific name, as far as I'm aware. In the reading I've done, it's just referred to as the growth of the genomes, but it doesn't have a more technical name that I know of.
Rich, thank you very, very much. Appreciate the question. I hope that was helpful to you. Up next is Mike in Missouri listening on iCatholic Radio or the iCatholic Radio app. Mike, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Father, my question is, at my church right now, we're not receiving the consecrated wine. Is that something that is specific to diocesan rule, or is that universal? And if so, do we foresee when we'll be able to start receiving it again? And then, based off the last caller, I did have one caveat question. Is the church recognizing evolution as accurate, or sticking with creationism?
Gotcha, Mike.
Okay, so in terms of the first question, and by the way, I'm not a father. I'm just this guy. As my personal brain care specialist, Gag Halfront, says, well, he's just this guy, you know? But in terms of the chalice, the decision tends to reside with the local bishop. And so I'm not aware of any directive that applies across the United States. That decision will tend to be made by the local bishop. There may be bishops in places that are now allowing reception under the form of wine at masses in their diocese. I haven't seen that happening, but it should be expected to resume once the pandemic passes to a certain point, because the liturgical documents encourage, they don't require, but they encourage the distribution under both kinds when it's possible and reasonable. And so when, in the judgment of the local bishop or possibly the local territory of bishops, decides that that it's sufficiently safe for people to receive, to begin receiving under both kinds again, then that will happen. So it is something that will happen, but as long as we don't get hit with another pandemic. But exactly when it will happen will be left up to the bishops to decide. The second question on evolution and creationism, the church doesn't see them as being in conflict. The church has reviewed the documents in Genesis, and it's reviewed the scientific evidence, and it said that these can be understood in harmony with each other. So what Scripture teaches is that God made everything, both in the cosmos at large and in the life forms that exist here on Earth. So God made all that stuff. He did create all that stuff. The question is how. And evolution, both cosmic evolution with the development of stars and galaxies, and biological evolution with the development of life forms, could be a tool that God used in creating the universe as we see it today. So the church doesn't have a problem with biological evolution, and it doesn't teach evolution, because, of course, evolution is a matter of science, not a matter of faith. So the church doesn't teach evolution, but it does not have a problem with evolution. And in the Catechism of the Catholic Church, it speaks positively of the many scientific studies that have splendidly enriched our knowledge of the age and dimensions of the cosmos and the development of life forms. So it's praising modern science for all the scientific studies that it has done on how big the universe is, how old the universe is, and how life forms on Earth developed. So it's speaking, even though it's not teaching evolution, it's speaking positively of evolutionary science.
And that brings us to our break, Mike. So I hope that was helpful to you. We'll continue with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin right after this.
There's only one Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Do you love praying for people? Have you ever wanted to use your gift of prayer to share Jesus with others and build up the body of Christ? Start a public prayer station with St. Paul Street Evangelization. Listen to people's needs, pray with them, or invite them to meet you at church. St. Paul Street Evangelization can help you get started. Find out how at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
He was a doctor of the church and one of the greatest defenders of Christ's divinity.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
St. Athanasius of Alexandria fought against the Arian heresy that questioned the divinity of Christ. He once condemned the Arians as opposers of Christ who had dug a pit of ungodliness. It was said of him, Athanasius contra mundum, Athanasius against the world, but for Christ. He died in 373.
For more about the Doctors of the Church, visit doctorsofthechurch.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin is our guest, and it is Open Forum, and that means your call is welcome, whatever the question, and whoever you are, you're welcome here. 888-318-7884. If you're not a Christian person, or if you're a fellow Christian but not a Catholic, you're welcome here with your question about what Catholics believe, or maybe about anything. Maybe you got a moral question or a philosophical question or a scientific question. It's all welcome. 888-318-7884.
Yeah, we've done like three scientific questions already this hour.
I noticed that. Yeah. Sarah in Indianapolis, Indiana, watching on YouTube. You are next, Sarah. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, gentlemen. It's a pleasure to meet you.
You too, Sarah.
I listen every single day that it's on. I really love your show. My question is, there's a couple in our church that have been married. We're married in the Catholic Church, and they practice contraception and have no intention whatsoever of having children. I went to the priest when I knew this and asked him about it, and he said, well, it's a matter of conscience. These two, this couple, also serve as extraordinary ministers of the body and blood of our Lord. And I'm just wondering, what is the Catholic view about that?
Well, what would you think the Catholic view about it would be?
Well, I didn't know what to think after the priest told me that it was a matter of their conscience.
Okay. Well, so the Catholic Church canon law requires that people who serve as extraordinary ministers of Holy Communion need to be living a life in accord with the teachings of the Church. And among the teachings of the Church are the fact that between married people, any use of contraception, properly understood for what it is morally illicit. And so people who know that this is the Church's teaching should not be serving as extraordinary ministers of Holy Communion because they are not living a life in keeping with the teachings of the Church. And so they would be disqualified from that role if it's publicly known that that's what they're doing. So that would be the answer.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Sarah. Let's go to James in Georgia, listening on the Quest Radio. That's in Atlanta, Georgia. We're glad you're here, James. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hey, Jimmy. Hey, Si.
Hey.
So I'm a catechist. I teach upper elementary students. And recently, they've been asking a lot about how only men can be priests, and they've been kind of confused about that. And I've taught them, you know, that Jesus only chose male apostles, so the church follows his tradition, and that he still treated women with a lot of respect based on the historical time period and the role of a priest acting in persona Christi. But I feel like some of the students are still not understanding this. Some are seeing that Jesus sees them as unequal. I don't want that to be the impression I give. So I'm wondering if you have any advice for me how I can kind of address this topic at a different angle.
Well, one of the things that I would do, I mean, there's only so much you can do because these kids are surrounded by propaganda that is hostile to the church, and you may not be able to overcome the effects of that propaganda. But one of the things that I would do is point out that being a priest is a gift. It's something that some men are able to do. They're able to serve God by being priests, but only some men. Most men do not serve God by being priests. Most men serve God by being laymen, and they can become fathers. Women serve God also. Some women serve God in a consecrated life, so they can be, you know, religious sisters and nuns. But most women serve God by being mothers. And there's a kind of parity between the sexes. Women get to serve God by being mothers, and men get to serve God by being fathers. And in some cases, men get to serve God by being spiritual fathers, whereas women get to serve God in a spiritual realm by being sisters and nuns. So there's a kind of complementarity between the sexes that reveals the fundamental equality of all of us. We have different roles. Men and women are not simply interchangeable, despite some of the claims you hear these days, but there's still a kind of fundamental equality among the sexes, and they need each other. We need priests, and we need women who are mothers too. The priests wouldn't exist without mothers, and the mothers need priests to help them get to heaven. So there's a kind of interdependence between these, between the different sexes and the different roles that they have.
James?
All right, Howard, thank you for your response. I appreciate it.
All right. Thank you, James. Thanks very much. Let's go to Tom in Elk Grove, California, watching on YouTube. Tom, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi. My question has to do with the second series of towards sainthood being declared venerable. I was just wondering if there's any teachings or what the church's perspective was related to. Now that we have so much more access to people's lives in the process of trying to discover heroic virtue, I wonder how that's going to be looked at by the church now, knowing that we can delve so deeply into, you know, people's Google searches or whatever, all the kinds of stuff we have access to information now, and what the threshold might be on declaring someone venerable.
Well, so in order for someone to be declared venerable, they have to have been declared to have lived a life of heroic virtue. And the Pope makes that declaration after the matter has been researched and a report has been submitted to him. And if he agrees that the person lived a life of heroic virtue, he can declare the person venerable. In terms of what the standard is, it's somewhat subjective on the part of the people who are preparing the report, because there's no real way to quantify, in most cases, the virtue that someone displayed during life. But you can certainly look at someone's life and say, okay, did this person lead an active Catholic life? And, you know, that doesn't mean throughout their entire life. They could have periods where they backslid or fell away or something. But did they return to the Lord before their death? And in that period where they were living an active Catholic life, did they notably do things that distinguished them as acts of holiness? Did they try to, you know, catechize people? Did they try to help the poor? Did they try to teach Christian doctrine effectively? Did they undertake a lot of prayer and fasting? And so one way or another, they need to demonstrate a level of spiritual activity that goes beyond just the normal. And that's a bit of a subjective judgment. In terms of the effect of modern big data, if that's what you're asking about, well, we'll have to see.
Yeah.
It certainly gives more information to the people who are investigating the person's cause for canonization. And that may make it easier to qualify them, or it may make it easier to disqualify them. Dealing with a huge flood of data is something that has been done for various saints in the past that have particularly well-documented lives. And given the amount of documentation that now exists, it'll be done for more in the future, I'm sure. That could have the effect of slowing down the canonization process, but we'll just have to see how it evolves. I don't know. Maybe at some point we'll have AIs that will be reviewing all the mountains of data on somebody.
Okay, Tom? Yeah.
Very helpful. Yeah, very helpful. Thanks so much.
All right. Very good. Thank you very much. We've got time. Let's go to Angelo in Phoenix, Arizona, watching on YouTube. Angelo, glad you're there. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, Si. Hi, Jimmy.
Hi, Angelo.
Jimmy, my question here is just your personal opinion on this matter. I tragically lost my son last year by his own hand.
Oh, sorry, Angelo.
So sorry.
I've had a real rough time with it, but luckily my faith has grown, you know, watching you guys. Mm-hmm. I've read a few books here by a Catholic priest in the United States, and he claims to have two-way communication with stuck souls, and I was just wondering if you're familiar with this person.
Is this Father Nathan Castle of the Dominicans?
Yes.
Okay, yeah, I know who he is.
And I just wanted to know, do you see what he's doing as valid in your personal opinion, Jimmy?
Well,
that he's communicating with, you know, angels and, given detailed information about the afterlife.
Okay. So Father Castle, to my knowledge, has not had an ecclesiastical investigation of his ministry done. And so there isn't a ruling on, you know, are his supernatural contacts with the dead or angels valid or not? Are they real or not? That's never been investigated by ecclesiastical authorities. So it's a matter that's open for discussion. God does let angels talk to some people sometimes. He does let the deceased talk to people sometimes, including souls in purgatory. And those are the so-called stuck souls that that Father Castle is attempting to help. He's written a couple of books about this. I've read one of them. And I plan, by the way, on doing a Mysterious World episode on Father Castle's ministry in the future. I may even interview him for it. I think that in principle, so what he reports is that he will have dreams in which a soul that's currently in purgatory will contact him. And then in prayer, he and various associates of his will try to help that soul that's in purgatory to move on. And that may involve a number of different things, but in essence, they're trying to help the soul move closer to God. And in principle, this is fine. There have been souls in purgatory appearing to people all the way down through history, asking for prayers and assistance of one form or another to help them move on. And in principle, there's nothing wrong here. Now, I have questions about some aspects of what Father Castle is doing, but fundamentally, the process that he is engaging in would be legitimate to try to help people in purgatory. And God does sometimes let people in purgatory contact the living. And God could allow a lot of people who are in purgatory to contact a single individual who is conducting a ministry to try to benefit them. So in all of those respects, I don't see a problem with what Father Castle is doing. That doesn't mean that these are genuinely supernatural events. I mean, these could just be dreams that he's having. There could be a big role of imagination here, or it could be a mix of things. It may be that sometimes he is helping a purgatorial soul, and sometimes he just thinks he is. So in the absence of doing a paranormal investigation of particular cases that he's covered, I don't have a way of assessing that. But in principle, you know, trying to help souls in purgatory is fine, especially if they contact you and ask for help. And so I have an open mind regarding Father Castle's ministry, although I do have some questions.
Angelo, what do you think?
That's great. How about, like, in history, has there been anybody like this that's been documented, that's been able to do and as much as he is? I mean, he's got the Blessed Mother that he's speaking with. He's speaking with, you know, a number of different angels with this two-way communication. So,
well, there have been individuals in the past who have reported multiple supernatural contacts with different heavenly figures. Sometimes they'll talk to Jesus and Mary and Joseph and Saint Michael, and so that's been reported. In fact, even like with the Fatima seers who did get investigated, they reported not only contact with the Blessed Virgin Mary, but also several contacts with an angel. Various saints appeared during the miracle of the sun, according to the report. So you do have multi heavenly figure contacts at least being reported.
Angelo, we are right now at the end of this hour, so we'll have to let you go. But many prayers for you, for your family, and most especially for your son.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that many of our listeners will pray for you and your son as well. Thank you very much. We are going to continue with Open Forum with Jimmy Akin as our guest next hour. Let me just check the lines. I'll tell you how many lines are open. Well, there's going to be two lines open as we go into the break, so you can get into that queue if you'd like. It's 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. Everybody's welcome, whether you are Catholic or not. Your question welcome here, 888 318-7884.